to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
Mike Robbins says, if we can figure out a way to be authentically gentle, kind, and loving to ourselves as we attempt to do whatever it is we attempt to do, our chances of success and fulfillment increase dramatically. With this in mind, Mike wrote his book, Nothing Changes Until You Do, to give readers an idea of what he means and how to accomplish it. Mike is my guest today, right here on Full Power Living. We've been on the air since 2004, bringing you a wide variety of guests and programs to enable you and us to understand and know the importance and power of our human emotions. We're broadcasting over blogtalkradio.com/FPL for Full Power Living and emotionalpro.com. We also distribute through iTunes. If you want to call and talk with me or my guests, please call our toll-free number, 888-498-0570. Mike Robbins is the author of the brand new book, Nothing Changes Until You Do, A Guide to Self-Compassion and Getting Out of Your Own Way, published by Hay House. He's a media personality, and he has two previous books, Focus on the Good Stuff and Be Yourself, Everyone Else Is Already Taken. They've been translated into 14 different languages. You can find more about Mike on his website, Mike-Robbins, R-O-B-B-I-N-S.com. Mike, welcome again to Full Power Living.
Hey, Eileen, thanks for having me back. Good to connect with you.
You had great success in your life starting at an early age. The New York Yankees wanted you to play ball with them as you were graduating high school. You decided to go to Stanford University instead, where you played in the College World Series. But then you had the injury when you were pitching for the Kansas City Royals.
Yeah.
But despite all of this that you've gone through, you're writing about what's fundamental to happiness and success. With all of that going on, what drew your attention to happiness and success?
Well, a couple of things, Eileen. I mean, I think, you know, and we probably chatted a little bit about this the last time I was on your show, but all those years playing baseball, I mean, I grew up in Oakland, California, near San Francisco, where you and I both still live here in the Bay Area, and baseball was my focus, and I was pretty good at it, as you mentioned. You know, the Yankees drafted me out of high school, even though I didn't sign with them. I went to Stanford, and then I got drafted by the Kansas City Royals out of Stanford. And, you know, but what was always most interesting to me, I mean, I was an athlete, I was really focused on that, but I come from a family where my father and many people on my father's side of the family suffered from pretty significant mental illness. My dad had bipolar disorder, and many relatives suffered from depression and anxiety and different issues of that nature. So I became aware of that early in my life. My folks split up when I was 3. My dad went through some pretty significant episodes of depression, and I didn't understand it as a kid. I mean, I heard the words, but when I was in college, actually, I was 20 years old at Stanford, I got pretty severely depressed myself. And here I was, you know, 20-year-old junior in college. I was playing baseball. I had lots of friends. I was doing well in school. I was sort of doing all the things you were supposed to do, right, to be happy and successful in life. And even though I was only 20 years old, I, in the midst of my own pain, and as I started to kind of come out of that depression, thanks to some great therapy and support and guidance from some really wonderful people around me, I remember thinking, you know, I think some of the rules of the game, so to speak, that we play in life, you know, maybe a little bit skewed if, in terms of the information and the training that we get. Like, you know, I had done all the right things. I had followed all the rules I thought I was supposed to, and I didn't find myself very happy. And I thought, you know, I'm sure I'm not the only one. And because I seem to be winning, quote unquote, the superficial game of life, at least at 20 years old, you know, I go to a good school and I'm a good athlete and all the things, checking off all the boxes, I think there's something deeper going on. So it was really kind of my start, even though it had probably even started a few years earlier as a teenager, really kind of delving into some deeper questions about life. And, you know, over the last 20 years, I'm 40 now, I mean, it's just continued to be my own personal pursuit of my own journey. And then after baseball ended and I'd gotten hurt and my career ended when I was quite young and I did a few years in the dot-com world, I started speaking and coaching and ultimately writing at the age of 26, and that's what I've been doing ever since.
Now, you just said something. You said, I followed all the rules I thought I was supposed to. And I know you have two daughters yourself.
Yep.
And it sparked a curiosity in me. Ostensibly, the rules are given to us so that we can have successful lives. And yet, as your life points out, following the rules wasn't necessarily the best thing for you. So I'm curious, what are you teaching your children about following the rules?
Well, you know, it's such an interesting thing, Eileen. I mean, there's, you know, I've been humbled in so many ways by parenthood. You know, my girls, Samantha and Rosie, are 8 and 5. And, you know, a friend of mine named Theo talks about, he has 3 kids, and he talks about wanting to write a book called The Pollyanna Parent Myth. It's the kind of parent you think you're going to be and then the kind of parent you actually are. And so, you know, my wife, Michelle, and I find ourselves challenged all the time in raising our girls in terms of things we say and do and what we're attempting to teach them. And, you know, there's a couple things that I really focus on with my girls, and I'll share a few stories, because these are stories from my new book as well as related to the question you just asked, but I think they're more universal than simply just parenting, although that's, you know, the form in which they've taken in my own life. I got a piece of advice from a counselor and mentor of mine when Michelle was pregnant with Samantha. So Samantha's 8 now, and, you know, so we're about to have our first baby, and you get lots of advice when you're about to have a baby, especially your first. And what Chris said to me, my mentor, he said, Mike, the most important job you have with your daughter is to teach her how to love herself.
Right.
And I said, okay, well, how do I do that? And he said, well, you love yourself and you let her see that. And that's how you teach her how to love herself. He said, look, it's not easy. It's not always even encouraged by our culture. You got to really make a commitment to it. It takes dedication. It takes focus. It takes practice. It takes a depth and awareness. He said, but if you really practice and embody a sense of loving yourself, your daughter will see that, and then she'll learn how to do it. So that's one key. And that isn't easy. He was right. I mean, and that's a core element of the work that I do, and like Nothing Changes Until You Do, this new book is a lot. One of the core themes is around loving and caring and being compassionate for ourselves. So that's one thing that we really attempt to teach the girls. In fact, just 2 days ago, you know, we live on a little cul-de-sac here in Marin County, and there's a couple of other little girls that live on our court. And one of the girls was over, and I was overhearing a conversation that my wife was having with our two daughters and one of the neighborhood kids, and they were talking about best friends, this whole concept of best friends, who's your best friend, who, you know, and... Mm-hmm. And so the little girl from next door said, well, some girl at school told me that I was her 7th best friend, and it really hurt my feelings, so I stopped saying that I had best friends. I just say I'm friends with everybody. And anyway, the conversation goes around, and then Samantha says, my 8-year-old says, well, Mommy always says that it's important for us to be our own best friend, so I'm my own best friend. And I was really touched by it, as was Michelle, like, wow, they're really listening, you know, and that is something that Michelle says to the girls all the time, that it's important to be your own best friend. And so, you know, that's one of the things that we're really trying to teach the girls is, again, about both in our own modeling of it as best as we can. And, you know, we're not perfect. We fall down on that quite often, quite frankly, but also just reiterating to them the importance of caring for and loving themselves.
When I was raising my children, one of them being just a little younger and one a little older than you are, I thought that the most important thing I could teach them was to make their own decisions and know how to process those decisions and then change them if they didn't work. But in recent years, I've come to the conclusion that the very most important thing that any child can learn is self-love, that making decisions is still important, but
when
you love yourself, you cannot go wrong, because then you're more available. I see the world as a giant school. I think we talked about this the last time you were on the show, too. And so when you love yourself, you're more likely to see something that comes up in your life as an opportunity to learn than if you don't. Yeah.
Absolutely. Well, and you know, I mean, I think that's such a great point. And look, I mean, decision making is really important, of course, and how we relate to ourselves sort of creates the context for all the decisions that we make. You know, there's another story that I find that I share often, because I think it's such an important and poignant example of this. And this is also something that I do with my girls. So it's something I'm attempting, Eileen, to teach them. But in the process, it's also teaching myself and reminding, you know, me and everyone around me. I play this little game with the girls, and I will ask them a question. I try to do this every day. I don't get to it every day, but, you know, if I'm putting them to bed or if we're just kind of, like yesterday, Rosie and I were riding bikes together, and I asked her, I'd say, you know, how much does Daddy love you? Mm-hmm. And the girls will respond. It's pretty cute. They'll raise their arms if, you know, she didn't do it on the bike because she would have fallen off the bike, but she'll say this much, or sometimes Rosie now says, to the moon and back, or whatever, you know, it's some little cute, and I say, that's right. And then I ask them a really simple but important question. I say, and how come Daddy loves you so much? And what the girls say in response is, because I'm me.
Mm-hmm.
And I say, that's right, honey, just because you're you. You know, and I do it for them because I want them to get the message. You know, I started doing this a couple of years ago. I don't even remember exactly how it started, but I want them to get the message, especially at an early age, you know, as little girls, like, I don't just love them because they're cute. I don't just love them when they listen. I don't just love them when they kick a goal in the soccer game or the teacher says something good about what they're doing in school and all that stuff. But I'm also doing it for myself for two reasons. First, as a parent, as a practice, you know, and you've raised kids, right? It's like,
right.
It's hard to remember that in the moment when they're driving you crazy, right? That you can love them even when you don't like what they're doing. So it's part of my commitment is that I want to love them unconditionally. But more importantly, quite frankly, I mean, I do it for myself because even though I know better, even though I've done a lot of work on myself, I understand the concept, I write books about this, I go out and give speeches about this, it's easy for me to forget or get caught in the notion or the idea that I'm only as valuable as my accomplishments or my appearance or whatever external, right? And so there's that piece that I'm continuing to learn, and the more I say that to my girls, the more I'm actually saying it to myself. And the truth for me with all of my work, and you know this, like knowing me and reading anything that I've written or talking to me, like I'm a big believer in the concept of teaching best what we most need to learn. Like the first and most important student of mine always is myself. And
yes.
Everything that I write and speak about, I'm always initially saying to myself because I got to keep reminding and remembering that, oh yeah, this is what matters. This is what's true. This is what's important.
You really point out the depth of the perceptions we inherit, I guess, from our culture and our world. I remembered a story as you were talking. When my daughter was six, she came back from a visit with her father. And she said to me one day, Mom, my dad loves me and likes me. And I said, well, that's really wonderful. I'm happy for you. And she said, do you love me and like me all the time? And I said, actually, I love you all the time, but I don't always like you all the time. And I said, well, tell me something. Do you like me all the time? And she said, no. And I said,
right.
Well, that's the same. We're both human beings, and that's what
exactly.
It is for human beings.
Well, and that's, you know, it's so interesting because I think that is such an important lesson, not only to teach children, but for us to get about ourselves, our relationships, but also in our relationship with ourselves. You know, I mean, one of the things I had the opportunity to do as I was working on this book, towards the end, actually, I had written most of it and was just kind of wrapping up with some of the editing, but I got connected with a woman named Dr. Kristen Neff, who's a professor at the University of Texas in Austin. And she is an expert in self-compassion. She wrote a book called Self-Compassion. She's been researching this and studying it for over a decade and traveling around the world speaking about it. And she was, I had a chance to interview her, actually, which was really cool because she said something. She said two things in the interview that I did with her. I recorded this interview because I wanted to share this with people in my community, and we posted it online for folks because we wanted people to get a chance to listen to what Kristen had to say. But she said, first of all, I was talking to her about self-compassion and how do we have compassion for ourselves, how do we accept ourselves, especially the areas of ourselves or our lives that we don't like. And she said to me, Mike, you don't have to like everything about yourself.
Ah.
And it was like the simplest comment, but I, what do you mean? Of course, you know, it just stopped me in my tracks. And I went, oh, really? And she said, yeah. It's like, she said, you don't like everything about your wife. You don't like everything about your children. You don't like everything about the people around you, but you still love and accept them, right? And it just, that simple idea, and then she went on to then make a distinction between self-esteem and self-compassion that I thought was really important because she said, look, here's self-esteem is fundamental. It's important. We know that. We know that in psychology. We know that the research tells us if people don't have self-esteem, right, we don't have a strong sense of self-esteem, a lot of problems can arise from that. She said, but what's happened is in our culture over the last couple generations is we focus so much attention on self-esteem, particularly in young people. She said one of the sort of, you know, negative, unintended consequences of focusing so much on self-esteem is that we've let our egos take over and think that because esteem is really about a global evaluation or assessment of our relative worth or value. We tend to do it in comparison to others. And we tend to think in order to feel good about ourselves, we have to be exceptional at everything. We have to be better than other people and shit. That actually sets us up for failure because it starts to move us in the direction of perfectionism and we're never quite good enough, and so it can be dangerous. Shit, self-compassion, on the other hand, is about, it's an in-the-moment phenomenon. It has three components. It's about kindness. Can we be kind to ourselves? About mindfulness, being aware of how we're operating and interacting, thinking, feeling, talking to and about ourselves. And also, the third piece of it is about global humanity, realizing that part of the human condition is that at times we have difficulties, at times we suffer, at times we are negative and critical towards ourselves. And instead of, what happens, some people get on their path of awareness or growth or insight, and then they notice their own negative self-talk or their own self-criticism, and then they start judging themselves or criticizing themselves instead of accepting the fact that, you know what, that's just part of being human. And so what was really interesting for me in really hearing her distinguish some of that stuff, and as I've been talking more about it in my own work, is can we, like you taught your daughter, love ourselves and have compassion for ourselves all the time, even and especially when we don't like certain things about ourselves, or we do something that we don't like, or we find ourselves caught in that negative pattern, whatever it may be, you know, have compassion and forgiveness for ourselves so that we can actually move through it and change in a genuine way.
Uh-huh. Someone gave me the term recently about not being okay, that when we see things in ourselves we don't like, we often conclude that we're not okay. And that,
right,
in fact, what you're saying is we are okay.
Yeah.
We may want to change something, but we're okay. We are who we are.
Exactly. And there's an important distinction also between fixing and changing. Fixing implies something's wrong, broken. It's basically shame-based, whereas change can come from a much healthier, much more positive place. We want to change something. We want to enhance something. We want to alter something. We want to shift it in a way, transform it so that it's more conducive to what we want, to where we are. And I had used fixing and changing interchangeably for most of my life until recently and started to see those two things are very, very different. So as we're attempting to, quote, change anything in our lives about ourselves, wanting to change something with our work situation, our body, our relationship, whatever it is, it's important to ask ourselves, where am I coming from with this? Is it coming from a place of something's bad and wrong and needs to be fixed? Or is it really coming from a place of a desire that I have to change in a positive way? And it may sound like word differences or semantics, but it's a completely different paradigm.
I don't want to go into this right now, but it strikes me that that's a problem with our New Year's resolutions. We tend to set it up for something to be fixed, i.e. wrong with us, and it doesn't work. We're up to our first break, Mike, and when we come back, I want to touch on this, but I'm going to go into it more. It's the whole issue of comparison. I'm talking today with Mike Robbins, author of No One Changes Until You Do, and Be Yourself, Everyone Else is Already Taken. Mike will share more about changing when we return here on Full Power Living. We'll be right back. Parent your child if he or she were a foreign exchange student. As a host for an exchange student, you'd have five main jobs to do. Those are the same five jobs important in raising kids. People around the world have used this approach to raise kids who are self-directed, make great decisions, and are immune to peer pressure. Get your copy of the Exchange Student Model for Parenting, written by me, Eileen Dillon, now available on Kindle. As a 41-year marriage and family therapist, a single, married, step, adoptive, and grandmother, I've got a thing or two to tell you that's going to lighten your load as a parent and help you create incredible kids who will become amazing adults. Go to Kindle.com and download the Exchange Student Model for Parenting today. Welcome back to Full Power Living. I have a few announcements. Next week, we have the last of a series of programs we've been featuring over the last 7 months. Sonia Rechnitzer, who's co-founder of Accessing Universal Intelligence, is making her final appearance on this show. She has been communicating with the higher selves of those of you listeners who've called in, giving you answers to questions you have about your life, tailored to you because they come directly from the highest and best part of you. We'll have a special guest receive Sonia's help, but there'll still be room for you to call for the answers you seek. So listen and call in next Thursday, July 17th, 9 a.m. Pacific time. And I want you to know I've been lining up guests for the show. We are currently scheduled through October. We have Anat Baniel, who studied and worked with Moshe Feldenkrais. She's going to share her approach to body movement that involves enticing the brain to make change and enable easier movement. I attended one of her workshops, and I want to tell you, her methods are amazing. We also have a program on the death monologues, and a woman named Omina will share her knowledge about your soul's history, and conscious film reviewer Brent Marchant is going to talk with us about the Movie Lover's Guide to the Law of Attraction. Today, I'm talking with Mike Robbins. He's been a guest on hundreds of TV and radio shows throughout the U.S. and Canada, such as ABC News, the Oprah Radio Network, Montel Across America, NPR, etc., etc. He's been featured in Forbes, in U.S. News and World Report, Self, in the Wall Street Journal, and many others. And he's been a regular contributor to Oprah.com and has blogged for the Huffington Post since 2008. So just as a quick aside, Mike, what did you need to change in yourself in order to become a speaker, consultant, author, and media guest?
That's a great question. I think it's a work in progress, Eileen. I mean, I think I'm constantly changing and evolving. I mean, I think initially, you know, where I was at 26 years old versus where I am at 40, which is where I'll hopefully be at 56 and 86 years old, assuming I'm still walking around the planet and doing this work, will probably continue to change and evolve. But I mean, I would say one big shift that's happened for me just recently, you know, I mean, I think initially it was more figuring out how do I get out of my own way so it's not so much about me, you know, because I think initially, and this sort of took some time, but I mean, just take public speaking as an example, and you know, because you speak quite a bit as well, and just or being on the radio here or whatever. Look, I mean, it can be nerve-wracking, right? And we stand up in front of a group of people or get on the radio or do whatever, and it's like, oh, gosh, how do I sound and what do they think? And, you know, that's kind of part of being human and having an ego. And so the initial process for me in getting over some of that to some degree was to learn how to put my attention more on other people. And for me, the beauty of speaking, and I love to speak. It's one of my favorite things to do. It's actually, for me, all about the connection. It's all about the interaction with people. Even you and I having this conversation right now is you and I having this conversation, connecting directly and knowing, even though we can't see them and talk to them and interact with them directly, that there are people out there listening to us. That, for me, is the real magic. And then more recently, what I noticed has changed, or what I've been working on changing, is something shifted a couple years ago for me, and it's continuing to shift. And I realized that my counselor, Eleanor, who I work with now, said something to me not that long ago. She said, Mike, if you're trying to prove it, you don't believe it. And that really hit me sort of right between the eyes, because I realized there's a piece of, after all these years of doing this work, there was still a big piece of me that was trying to prove something. I don't know exactly what I was trying to prove or to whom. You know, both my parents have passed away, so I wasn't trying to do anything for my parents, not in a practical sense, right? I don't know that I was trying to prove anything to my wife or my girls, or I don't know, but it was this kind of, and something has been shifting in me that it's like, I don't know, a deeper level of peace and acceptance and even more authentic confidence that I'm not trying so hard to be good at what I do anymore. I'm really attempting to figure out how to have as much joy and fulfillment in it, but also how do I have the greatest impact. And that's been a fun thing to play around with, because it's not that my little ego doesn't pop up still and want to be impressive and want to prove something or, hey, look at me or whatever, but I'm much more mindful of it. I'm much more even compassionate with myself when it does show up, and I can shift my attention towards how do I actually serve? How do I connect? How do I really have impact for whomever I'm in front of? And it's not just when I'm on stage giving a speech or doing an interview like this, but it's when I'm in the airport or when I'm, you know, at, you know, playing in the court with my girls and their and the neighborhood kids or wherever, because that's really why I started doing this in the first place, you know?
Wow. That's really great. You know, recently we had Dr. and Mr. Shah on the show.
Mm.
And mm-hmm. I told him that I'm 71 now and my health is good and my I have good energy and so forth. And I was kind of curious from his perspective as a healer, what enables one person to be that healthy at 71 and another one not? And he touched on something that you just offered, really. He said it's all about serving others.
Yeah.
And that's what you shifted into. You shifted into, that was the thing you said, being concerned about what you're offering to the people you
yeah.
talk with or contact. So
yeah. I think for all of us, at least I can just speak from my own experience and where I am at this stage in my life, and it may continue to evolve, and you know, you would probably have some perspective on that that I don't have, and I think at the same time, though, I think we continue to evolve through different aspects of ourselves and our life. And look, the culture that we live in, it's complex. It's got lots of facets and levels to it. But a lot of what we're encouraged to, this is back to the question you even asked me before the break about the rules, you know, if you will, the rules that we're raised by is this idea.
Right.
I don't think we're raised in a sense overtly to be selfish and only think about ourselves. That's not necessarily the case. But a lot of what gets rewarded in our culture is about accomplishment and achievement on a personal level. I mean, we do lip service as well as at times acknowledgement to someone who really does contribute and give back. But even that, it's often in the form of look at the money this person has donated or look at the building this person has built or look at the, you know, and that's all well and good. And look, I mean, I'd love to be in a position in my life where I can be building buildings and donating significant amounts of money. But even in and of itself, I think sometimes, I mean, I will talk to Eleanor about this, and Eleanor says something to me like, you keep thinking you have to be Oprah before you can go really make an impact in the world. Like, you don't. That's your ego. Like, you're making up some story about it. It really is service is about, it's a way of being. It's about how we operate. It's not so much even about what we do.
What we're talking about ties in well with the issue. You have a chapter in your book, Nothing Changes Until You Do. You have a chapter on comparison. And I was warned many years ago not to compare, because no comparison that you make of yourself with another person is a true comparison, because a true comparison,
right.
you have to compare everything.
Right.
And it seems like when you're focused on serving people and doing what's right for them and sharing your talent, you really don't have room to compare.
Yes. Well, you know, Mark Twain said comparison is the death of joy. So I think that that's so true. Look, it's hard to stay away from it completely. I mean, again, it's part of, I think, how the ego operates. I was speaking a few weeks ago at a bookstore locally here in the Bay Area talking about Nothing Changes Until You Do, and someone asked a great question. They said, they asked me, Mike, how do you deal with comparison and social media? Right? So we're talking about Facebook and Twitter and all these ways that we communicate these days, a lot of us, right? And I said, you know, and I appreciated the question, because she was saying, you know, sometimes I get on Facebook and I look and I see all these people and they're posting all these happy pictures and they're on vacation and everyone looks wonderful and it makes me feel bad about myself, she said, right? And I looked at the group at the bookstore and I said, how many of you have had that experience? And every single person in the room raised their hand. And I said, so here's the thing. I said, I know for myself that if I'm not mindful about it, I can go down that dark tunnel of negative comparison that doesn't serve me. And look, the reality is, it's either heads or tails. Heads we think we're better, tails we think we're worse, but it's the same coin, right?
Right.
And the story that I share in the book is I got an email, this was a few years back, from a friend of mine who says, hey, Mike, you got to check out this speaker, and sent me a link to somebody's website. He's great. He seems, you guys kind of remind me of each other. Do you know him? And I click on the link. I go to the site. I don't know this guy, but I'm looking at a few videos, and immediately, and this was a few years back, and I thought my website was so outdated, and it was bad, and I was dealing with all this insecurity about that, and I look at this guy's website, and it looked fantastic to me, and I watched the video, and he's great, and the little voice in my head just starts going, dude, you're a loser. Look at this guy. He's so much better than you. All that. So, I mean, it just started. And within 30 seconds, I felt like someone punched me in the gut. And I all of a sudden just had this massive self-criticism attack. And I'm sitting there in front of my computer, and it was, you know, and coming back to the woman's question from the other night, a couple weeks ago, about Facebook. And what I said to her was, I just said, look, I think we all just have to be mindful. I'm mindful of myself in that I can go down that path. So I got to be careful. I mean, in some ways, it's almost like I look at Facebook like a drug, right? Like a drink, if you will. It's like I engage with it, and I do think there's really positive aspects of it. But if I'm not careful, all of a sudden it turns into comparison with other people, or how many people like my post or like my page, or all this ridiculousness that I didn't even know what that meant 5 years ago, and now all of a sudden I'm determining how valuable I am based on some arbitrary determination that doesn't even really mean anything. So I think that there's a way in which we can be mindful of comparing. There can be positive aspects of it if we learn from other people in a healthy way. But for the most part, as Mark Twain said, right, comparison is the death of joy. And when we go into it, like you said, we're not comparing the whole thing. I'm comparing the external version of you and what I make up, positively or negatively, but I don't know the full, complex, everything that's going on over there, so I can never make a valuable or authentic assessment of comparison. Even if I could, who cares? Right? Like, why is that even relevant?
Right. We have a couple of comments here on the chat, which I'd like to read to you.
Yeah.
We are all a work in progress, Mike. I appreciate the way you live it out loud for all to see and how rewarding it can be to keep it real and fun, too.
Yeah. Oh, well, thank
then
you.
Then she says, I would add, Eileen, that it's about serving life even more than serving ourselves or our children or others.
Yeah,
that's an interesting thought.
That is. I mean, I think it's, you know, it's funny because even in my own shift around some of this recently, Eileen, I would often hear people talk about service or hear, you know, and it wasn't that it didn't resonate with me, but there was something, I was still kind of working through my own, where does that land for me authentically? But I think that idea of serving life, you know, because I think sometimes the danger, I think, this idea of serving others, I sometimes bristle a little bit at that, and I don't mean that in a selfish way, like serving others isn't a good thing. It's a beautiful thing. But I think what can happen is we get caught, and especially as parents, especially as caregivers, especially as sensitive, giving people, right? I remember having a conversation with my aunt a number of years ago. I was in my 20s at the time. My aunt has two daughters who are similar ages as me and my sister, and they were in their 20s, early to mid-20s. And my aunt says to me, very authentically, very vulnerably, we're having this conversation, you know, I'm concerned about my girls. They're not doing a very good job taking care of themselves. And she said, you know, I didn't, Mike, for the longest time I couldn't figure it out, and I didn't understand why, because I had really done everything I could to create a loving, nurturing environment around them growing up. And she said, and then it finally hit me a few weeks ago. She said, I spent all those years taking care of my girls. And with everything going on in life and how challenging some things were at times, I didn't do a very good job taking care of myself in those days. So my girls literally never grew up seeing what it looks like for a grown woman to take care of herself, and now they're becoming women, and they don't know what that looks like. And she said, and I'm trying not to be too harsh on myself about it, but it made sense to me because it was a disconnect until I realized, oh, they didn't have the model. So the thing about serving life, as the comment on the post there was, right, on the chat, that's a great way to think about it, serving others, serving ourselves, serving God, if that's what's important to you, just in service. So it's not, but it's not irrespective of ourselves, because I think one thing that happens, and Eileen, I'm sure you know this, we all know it from experience, we can put so much of our attention on caring for and serving others that at times we forget to serve ourselves in a healthy way, and that can render us bitter at the end of the day, you know?
You are not going to have this opportunity, but I was single parent for my two birth children for 20 years. And that was the biggest lesson I learned during those days, was that if I didn't take care of myself, nothing went right.
Yeah.
Because I'd either get sick or tired or grouchy or something like that. And so I reversed what I'd been taught and made myself the most important person on the chain.
Yeah.
Not in a selfish way, but in a way to care for myself.
It's probably, Eileen, to some degree, I mean, even though you asked the question in the interview you had recently, and it was about service, but that, I would imagine, is one of the key components that has you healthy and vibrant and engaged in your life, where you are in the stage of life. Because I do think, look, I mean, I was raised by a single mom, and, she struggled significantly on a lot of levels with caring for herself because, you know, as you know, it's relentless. I mean, I look at Michelle, my wife, who is not a single mom, right? We're both here doing the best we can to take care of the girls, but sometimes I'm on the road and she does sort of have that experience, at least in very short stints, of what it's like. And we both talk to each other about the importance of us nurturing ourselves in service, not just of our girls, but of ourselves. Because again, it's like we can't go out and serve in the world the way that we want to if we don't serve ourselves first. And it's tricky because, again, we can go down a path along those lines where it can start to become selfish and self-serving. Most of us won't and don't. But even the thought of it, I mean, one of the pieces of feedback that I've gotten over the years with my work, and especially this more recent book, right, because Nothing Changes Until You Do, is really about put yourself first, love yourself, have compassion for yourself, keep things in perspective, like nothing changes until you shift. So really put some healthy attention on yourself. But I was speaking at Google about a month ago, and I started my talk with a question: what makes it difficult or challenging for you to be compassionate with yourself? And people paired up, and a woman raised her hand, and I was glad she said it because she spoke for a lot of us in the room. She's like, if I'm too compassionate with myself, I won't be able to achieve my goals. Right? And this is, I mean, I'm at Google, so this is a lot of very young, ambitious people, right? But then we had this whole long conversation about, well, what does it actually mean to be compassionate with ourselves? Similar to this idea, if I love myself too much, I'll be arrogant, I'll be narcissistic, people won't like me, people will think I'm just all about me. But that's almost never the case. If we authentically love and care for ourselves, it's not narcissistic, it's not self-absorbed, it's actually beautiful and healthy.
Yes, I totally, totally agree with you. I'm so glad you're saying that, because this is a message we really need to hear. We have a funny dichotomy, I think, in our culture. You can see it sometimes with some of the shows where people are showing off their talents, you know, their singing ability or their dancing ability, where especially in the first few rounds, when people are rejected, they have such an unrealistic, positive self-view that they get angry at people saying they're not good enough, when anybody watching will go, oh, my God, thank goodness they helped them from the show. You know?
Exactly.
So we have that dichotomy on one hand, and on the other hand, being totally self-sacrificing. And we need to get more to the middle, I think.
Yes. Well, it's also, I think, in that dynamic, I think it's also about depth and realness, because on either side of that continuum, there's a certain amount of superficiality, right? I mean, the self-criticism even. I mean, it's the ego saying, not good enough, not good enough, not caring for myself, I'm self-sacrificing, thinking that's the noble thing, when in reality, if we go deeper, those people that think, oh, I'm the greatest in the world, doesn't anybody see how fantastic I am? It's like, how about we go deeper, you know, sort of disconnect from the ego and go down into more of what's true. And then I think we come to that natural middle point in a much more authentic way.
Uh-huh. That's a really, really good point. We're up to our second break, Mike. This program's charging through.
Flying by.
Nobody changes until you do. My guest today is Mike Robbins. He's got a wonderful book that gently challenges all of us to start making the changes necessary for us to move successfully to happiness in our own lives. And I'm going to talk with Mike a little bit about embracing your powerlessness when we return here on Full Power Living. We'll be right back.
How difficult is it for you to ask directly for what you really want? To take responsibility graciously and willingly for your mistakes, or to relate with others because it's fun instead of because you need something from them. Most people believe manipulation and codependence are normal behaviors for adults. They may be common, but they're not normal. Manipulative behaviors really are designed to be part of childhood, to be put away as things of the past when we become adults. So, if you're ready to let manipulation and codependence be part of your past, then get the mini course I've created for you, Ending Codependence, The Bottom Line. I'm Eileen Dillon, the Emotional Pro, offering you a formula that you can follow for creating healthy, manipulation-free, and lasting intimate relationships. I also give you the tools and principles that you can use to develop lasting immunity to codependence. Get Ending Codependence today at www.emotionalpro.com. That's emotionalpro.com.
All right, welcome back to Full Power Living. I just want to give you Mike Robbins' website, which is mike-robbins.com. You can find out more about Mike there. And, Mike, can people get all of your books there?
Yeah, absolutely. There's links on the site where you can buy all the books. So all the info about me and the books is at mike-robbins.com.
Great. Well, now, you have quite a bit about emotions, and certainly a number of the things, situations that you described have emotions involved with them. And as
sure.
you just heard in that ad, I'm known as the emotional pro. But
yes.
I want to talk a little bit about some of the things that you have to say. You say the reality is that emotions are positive. They're positive when we feel and express them in a healthy way, and negative when we suppress them. And you add to this the notion that emotions are not sustainable.
Yeah.
I really like these statements. I'd like to know more of what do you mean by emotions are not sustainable?
I mean, look, you're the emotional pro, so now I'm all of a sudden feeling a little self-conscious to be talking about emotions with you, but I'd be curious to collaborate.
Would you compare yourself, please?
Yeah, let's compare. Let's see who's right about the emotion thing and who has right. Well, I mean, what I'm saying basically is that, look, human emotions aren't sustainable in the sense that when we experience an emotion, any emotion, if we actually feel it, it will move through us. It doesn't hang around. You know, I mean, I say this sort of seriously but jokingly sometimes when I speak about it. I say, look, how many of you have ever been really excited, right? Raise your hand. People raise your hand. I say, you don't like stay excited like all day just like jumping out of your skin. You kind of get excited and you feel it and you express it and it kind of has a way of sort of dissipating, right? And similarly, it's like if we're feeling really sad and we actually allow ourselves to really feel the sadness and allow ourselves to get moved to tears and the sadness moves through us, it's not that it goes away completely, but there's something that shifts as we really feel and express that emotion. The problem is more when we get stuck. And a couple of the ways we get stuck with our emotions, Eileen, and you know this in the work that you do, of course, is that we don't acknowledge them, we don't feel them, we avoid them, we stuff them down, right? Oh, no, I can't get angry, I'm not an angry person. No. I can't express my fear because I'll be seen as, we, you know, we start judging and evaluating and sort of compartmentalizing our emotions. You know, and one of the people who I really respect and admire and appreciate her work out in the world in the past few years is Brené Brown. And what she talks a lot about, which I totally agree with, is like you can't, if you're going to squelch the fear and the doubt and the worry and the anger and the right shame and all the bad ones, it actually has an impact on the more positive side because we're holistic beings and we experience all emotions. And so my belief is that, you know, emotions are positive, again, when we feel them and express them in a healthy way. They're negative when we don't. Because sometimes even positives, I mean, a lot of my work, my first book, Focus on the Good Stuff, is all about appreciation. There's a lot of conflict that actually can arise from not expressing the positive emotion of appreciation and gratitude. So we withhold that, right? This happens in relationships all the time. You get upset with our spouse, our friend, our family member, and we actually do really appreciate them, but we're busy being pissed or whatever, or, you know, righteous about something, and so we don't express it. And oftentimes the real sadness, like when someone dies, it's missing them, yeah, but it's like, wow, why didn't I tell them how much I love them? Why did I waste my time and energy being mad about some stupid thing they did 5 years ago?
This is interesting. Tied into this, my next question was about vulnerability, but on the chat. Does Mike address vulnerability? I believe that protecting our vulnerability is where many of us get stuck in being able to love ourselves. How does Mike find the courage to move through it? And yes, Brené Brown is fabulous.
Yes. Well, I mean, vulnerability is core to everything that I'm talking about, everything we're talking about here, Eileen. It's not so much even vulnerability like the concept. Like, right, I wrote a book, Be Yourself, Everyone Else Is Already Taken, which is all about authenticity and vulnerability. But there's the topic of it or the concept of it, and then there's the real McCoy, the real deal. And being vulnerable is allowing ourselves to experience emotional risk. Right? It's stepping into the void. It's at some level always going to feel a bit uncomfortable and scary. That's the nature of it. And we do avoid it. We do shy away from it. Even, again, as we're talking about emotions, it's like, oh, I don't, people, you know, this happens a lot, Eileen, when I go into, because a lot of the work that I do in the corporate world, right? And what's interesting when I go into work in the corporate environment is a lot of times whether I'm speaking at a big conference or event or I'm coming in and I'm kind of facilitating or working with a, you know, leadership team or whatever, oftentimes when I speak or when I work with groups, what will come out at some point throughout the session or is some emotion, and even in the form of tears. And I'm not ever trying to make anybody cry. That's never the intention per se, but I'm always trying to make it safe for people to get real and for them to tap into what's true for them, tap into their hearts. And when that happens sometimes, especially when people are stressed out and haven't been expressing themselves, one of the things that will show up often is some emotion in the form of tears. And it's amazing to me to watch in environments where normally that's not the case, because that is a huge vulnerability. Like, oh my gosh, I'm crying at work, and people get all weird and start apologizing, and right, and I try to have compassion as much as I can, and I will often say to them, listen, you don't have to apologize to me or anybody for being human. Like, that's just part of being human. You know, and so the thing is, though, when it's new or it's different or it's out of the comfort zone or out of the set of norms that we create in a group or even for ourselves, that's when it steps into that place of vulnerability. Look, and the thing about vulnerability is it's important to create environments that are more conducive to it or that feel safer. Like, I'm in a men's group, and that's one of the most important places for me to go every other week and sit with a group of men that I really trust, and I can be vulnerable there and express certain things there that in other cases, in other situations, even with my wife, who I share just about everything in my world with, I can sit in that circle of men and say things and get support in ways that I don't always get in other places in my life, and I feel safe to go to an even deeper level of vulnerability. And I think for each of us, whether it's personally or professionally, finding safe ways, safe containers, if you will, sitting down and working with a therapist or an expert like yourself or somebody who really can, right, hold that confidential and safe place, that's really important for all of us to have in our lives in various ways.
Right. And I would add to that, Mike, that my learning is that vulnerability is one of the skills of love. So when you're talking about loving yourself and loving others, you are required, I guess, by the system, not you don't have to, but the system requires that you be vulnerable, otherwise you're not fully loving to yourself or to others.
Exactly. I mean, it's about intimacy and intimacy with others but ourselves, so that vulnerability is so important. And look, again, initially and in the moment of it, it's going to feel scary, right? Like, again, it's way easier for me to talk about vulnerability than it is to be vulnerable. It takes more courage to be vulnerable than to talk about it, right? That being said, it's those moments of, you know, one big thing that we can do to even enhance our capacity for vulnerability is ask for what we want.
Mm-hmm.
Right? I mean, one question I love to ask when I'm speaking to groups of people, I'll say to the group, and it doesn't matter if it's 10 people or 1,000 people, it doesn't matter if I'm here in the San Francisco area or if I'm in Texas or New York or in Europe, it doesn't matter where I am. I'll say, how many of you like helping other people? Right? And everybody in almost every room I've ever been in over 14 years of speaking to groups of people, everybody raises their hand, right? Being of service, who doesn't? I mean, some of us are more oriented that way than others, but yeah, I like helping other people. Now, look, and I'll say, look, we're often busy, and it's not like we wake up in the morning with just abundant time to go run and help everyone. That would be great. But when, you know, it feels good, right? And I say, and then I ask a second question. I say, how many of you love asking other people for help? About 10% on average. This is my, you know, unscientific sort of assessment over these all these years. About 10% on average in most rooms, in most groups, will raise their hand, and there's usually kind of an awkward little laugh, and I will often say in response, look, those of you who just raised your hands, bravo to you. Help teach the rest of us how to do that, because that's so important. It takes courage. It takes vulnerability, but if you start getting better and more comfortable asking for help, a couple things will happen. Number one, you get way more support that way. You don't have to burden yourself and be a martyr and all, you know, we get past the like, oh, they're going to think I'm weak, they're going to think I can't do it, and you'll find that a lot of people will actually respond positively to, yeah, it's scary. Sometimes they'll say no. Sometimes they won't help you the way you want them. Sometimes it could be potentially awkward. And yes, you are making yourself vulnerable. But the other thing, and this is the sort of reframe that I really like to underscore, is that given that almost all of us love helping other people, if we could shift our perspective that when I ask for help, not only is it self-serving, yeah, I might get something that I want, I might get some help and support, I'm actually practicing being vulnerable, building up my courage, and even more important than both of those things, I'm giving another human being an opportunity to do something that most human beings love to do, help another person. And if we think of it that way, ironically, our ask for help can actually be an act of service to someone else, even though they're going to be the one serving. If no one receives help, we don't get the help.
Mm-hmm. Before we stop, talk to me about embracing your powerlessness.
Well, this relates to the conversation about emotions. So I share a story in that particular chapter, and nothing changes until you do. And you know, I mean, the book is set up, it's 40 short essays, right? It's a series of stories and insights. And in a few of them, like that one chapter, I actually share a particular technique and practice that Eleanor, my counselor, taught me. And there's a meditation that actually goes along with it that's both in the appendix, but I also recorded an audio of this meditation that people can download for free. You just go to mike-robbins.com/meditations with an S on the end. But it's basically, this is the idea. Eleanor says to me in one of our sessions, Mike, it sounds like embracing powerlessness would be something that would be good for you at this time. And we do our sessions on the phone. I almost dropped the phone. I like wanted to swear at her. I was like, what are you talking about, embrace powerlessness? That sounds terrible. Like, almost sounded like a bad word, right? I said, Eleanor, like, I'm all about empowerment of myself, of others. Why in the world would I want to embrace powerlessness? And she said, the feeling of powerlessness is totally different than the state of being of powerlessness. I said, what do you mean? She said, if you can embrace the feeling of powerlessness, it will actually empower you. Again, the idea of feeling an emotion allows it to move through us. She said, what happens is you create stories that you're not, you know, you're disempowered, and then you walk around as a way of being like, I'm powerless, which isn't true. So we started to go into it, and the meditation technique she taught me was to go in and close my eyes and just visualize, imagine myself laying on a field of grass, the grass turns into water, and I'm floating. And I'm just laying there. So this is something that I do as kind of a, you know, guided imagery thing for myself. And then she said, the mantra is this. I give myself permission to feel powerless. Just because I feel powerless doesn't mean I am powerless. And keep repeating that mantra until you actually have the experience of feeling the powerlessness, but feeling yourself supported by the water. And then it starts to not just the concept, but the real visceral experience of feeling something isn't being something. And then in the visualization, then the water turns solid again, back on the grass, kind of come out of the visualization. I mean, it only has to take 5 or 10 minutes. I think the audio I recorded is like 10 minutes long, but doing that meditation, which, by the way, you can do with any emotion, anger, fear, jealousy, anything. Because just because you feel jealous doesn't mean you are jealous. Just because you feel angry doesn't mean you are angry. And again, it's not just words and semantics. It's a different paradigm. So we give ourselves permission to feel the emotions that we feel because we're human beings and we're emotional creatures. And if we feel them and then move through them, all of a sudden it's like, wow, if I allow myself to really authentically feel my fear for a full minute before I go on stage to speak when I'm actually feeling it, I will be so much more in my heart, so much more connected, so much more authentic, so much more grounded and real than if I try to avoid it in some way and play a song to pump myself up to go overcome my fear, which is how most of us have been trained to deal with our emotions.
Wow, that's beautiful. That's music to my ears. And by the way, for your interest in comparing your knowledge about emotions to mine, I would say that I, number one, have no disagreement with anything you've said about emotions.
Okay, good. I'm glad.
So, on the chat, we have thanks to both of you for this conversation. All that has been said here today makes it easier for me to be human, real, and happy about it. You guys are great.
Nice. There. Thank you.
Yes. So one last thing, Mike. Most of us, I think, especially here in the U.S., we've been taught to work long and hard. And
yes.
You say allow things to be easy. And you know, I think you, in reading your book, it was so clear that you were following your own advice about allowing things to be easy. And as I read your book, I could feel myself shifting easily, even in many areas that I'd already worked on in myself, because your own warmth, just like in this interview today, your own warmth and self-compassion and love come through in the book. And the effect of it was to leave me open to making change. It took resistance right out of me. So I want to thank you for that.
Well, thank you for
really
saying
that. Yeah.
I appreciate that very much.
All right. Well, thank you for writing Nothing Changes Until You Do, and thank you for being you, for sharing your vulnerability. And thank you for being with me here once again on Full Power Living today. It's been a great pleasure having you.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me on again. It's wonderful to connect with you, Eileen.
All right. Don't forget us with your next book now.
Absolutely.
Okay. Next week, join me for our final show with Sonia Rechnitzer, who's co-founder of Accessing Universal Intelligence. Sonia will be answering your questions by consulting your own higher self. It's quite a demonstration. Sonia and her husband Daniel are returning to Australia for a time, so they won't be available to do the show at 3 in the morning. So don't miss Sonia's swan song on Full Power Living for this go-round next Thursday, July 17th at 9 a.m. Pacific time, which is noon Eastern time. Paul Johnston of Fresh Talk Media has been our producer. Thank you, Paul. For now, I'm Eileen Dillon, your host, reminding you, pay attention not to what you want to overcome, but to what you want to become.
You're listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.